hope to stay on Sirat al-Mustaqim, the true path that Allah revealed for us in the Holy Quran. And, you know, really to read the Holy Quran and its message and take it on board for what it really is, the ultimate goal is for the salvation of man. And it just leaves me to thank our listeners and to thank you, sir, as well. And wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening and goodbye. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. The Light.
We don't know much about woolly mammoths that went extinct some 10,000 years ago, except their scant references in archaeology books. Now, scientists have discovered that the giant mammals could walk incredibly long distances. Scientists from the University of Alaska have concluded that a male mammoth named Kik covered enough ground on its 28-year lifespan to encircle the Earth twice. That's a lot. To come up with the data, paleontologists analyzed one of Kik's well-preserved tusks. They say the animal lived with a herd through its infancy and youth, and then went on to live alone. Scientists hope they will learn more about mammoths by analyzing further data from Kik's remains.
After an epic 17-month journey that drew international attention, China's famous herd of wandering elephants has finally returned home. Wildlife protection officials said the elephants safely crossed a bridge over the Yuan River to reach their protected habitat. The Asian elephants also received a little encouragement from wildlife rangers to help them get home. Staff used corn trails as bait and built artificial roads to ensure the herd took the right route. The 1,300-kilometer odyssey that began in March captivated audiences with several highlights. One of the highlights was the birth of a calf in November. In June, drone footage was captured of the 14-member herd as they were sleeping outside of a village. In Indonesia, a group of university lecturers have come up with an idea of building a robot to help people during the coronavirus pandemic. The robot is assembled from electric household items like pots and pans and an old television monitor. It was named Delta after the new coronavirus variant ripped through Indonesia. The robot was initially built to entertain residents of a village in the country's East Java province. But the head of the robot-making project says he decided to shift his function into assisting people dealing with a deadly virus.
With this new Delta variant and the surging number of COVID-19 cases, I decided to turn the robot used for public services into one that sprays disinfectant and delivers food and necessities of residents who are self-isolating. I'm shifting the function to serve only the members of the community who are in need.
The interesting thing about a robot is that it greets people when delivering things to isolated residents. The developers of the robot say it has been built in a joint project with local people and is by no means a high-tech device. The world's oldest wooden boat belonging to Egyptian pharaoh King Khufu has been moved to its new home in a painstaking transfer process. It took 48 hours to move the 20-ton vessel to the Grand Egyptian Museum from the Giza pyramids. It was carefully fixed inside a metal cage and carried on a remote-controlled vehicle. The 4,600-year-old vessel, also known as Solar Boat, was not built to sail through seas. In ancient Egypt, pharaohs commissioned solar boats, which were essentially virtual vessels to transport them to the afterlife. To fulfill their purpose, they were buried in pits next to royal burial chambers. Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain proved that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This non-figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
Egypt's forgotten art of Fatik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cleft decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of batik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now skillful artists in her workshop who design colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
Artists in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite the tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Karamus in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing, and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The Pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together, and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, the industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artists to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We made products out of papyrus paper, like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
You can find tin boxes in every house, with people often throwing them away after consuming what they had inside. But an old lady in Belgium has turned it into an obsession for years to fill her home with these fascinating containers. 83-year-old Madame Dardenne has gathered around 60,000 vintage tin boxes in a span of 30 years. The empty containers of all sizes now occupy four other houses. They once used to hold all kinds of goods, ranging from coffee, biscuits, tobacco, tea and soap to shoe polish, are now piled high all over the building that belongs to Dardenne. Some of these boxes, according to her, come from as far as India and Japan. Dardenne says it all started with a chocolate box that was given to her with a painting of a blonde girl in a blue hat.
I consider this box to be the first of my collection. It is a box of Belgian Côte d'Or chocolates that a relative of my husband gave me, believing that I was interested in boxes.
She sees the boxes as history books with decorations and writings on them describing major events and reflecting contemporary culture. The collection is the largest in the world, listed by the Guinness Book of Records. Located in eastern Belgium, the museum can be visited by appointment. Humans have damaged the environment perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Juan Carlos Rodriguez and his wife run a sloth rescue center in the lush outskirts of the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. They have so far saved over 45 sloths. The couple decided to start helping the furry mammals last year after running into a sloth that had been badly injured. They saved him and called him Chewy, after a character in the popular Star Wars franchise. Juan and his wife are now alone in their life-saving journey. Are not alone in their life-saving journey, as their vet friends also help them with services and donations. The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted lives all around the world, but it's important to try to stay fit for humans and animals alike. Penguins in an open zoo in Thailand have been keeping their daily routines, although no visitors are allowed due to COVID-19 restrictions. They are regularly taken out of their air-conditioned enclosure so they can enjoy a walk or swim. The 41 flightless birds consume nearly 25 kilograms of fresh fish each day. The cute animals at the zoo are aged from 1 month to 18 years old.
South Korean medical workers manning drive-through coronavirus testing centers have a new way to cool off and rest amid hot summer days: recovery buses. The medical workers are now able to enjoy their breaks at these buses, which are equipped with air conditioning, cold water, and snacks. The workers are allowed to take off their protective suits that trap heat and create an environment difficult to tolerate. Some of the buses also have shower booths and bunk beds to help the medical workers deal with their hard work. They say the buses are refreshing.
I almost feel like I'm stuck in a heat dome, like in a car with the air conditioner off in the middle of summer. It's so hot that it's even hard to breathe. But when I come here during the break time and rest in a much cooler and more pleasant environment like an igloo, I can recharge and work cheerfully in the afternoon.
These buses were first designed and used as resting places for Korean police officers and firefighters. Now, 22 of them are deployed to testing centers across the country. The government is considering deploying more recovery buses amid rising temperature and a new wave of coronavirus infections.
An aquarium in the French capital, Paris, is celebrating the birth of a baby black-tip shark. The female shark is 55 centimeters long and weighs 560 grams. She's currently quarantined in a small pond so she wouldn't come under attack by adult sharks. Officials at the aquarium say she'll be ready to swim amongst other sharks in 3 to 4 months. She was born last week at the aquarium, an event the caretakers say is very rare.
It's a rare event for us, which hadn't happened here for the past 5 years. The birth is quite rare in aquariums and in captivity in general. In fact, there are often embryos that won't survive, or they're sometimes stillborn. That's what makes it a rare event, which also occurs at night. We had the chance to observe it during the day, which allowed us to intervene very quickly, and we're able to recover the little one.
The International Union for the Conservation of Nature has designated black-tipped sharks as a vulnerable species. It's particularly poached in some countries for their distinctive fins. The marvelous creatures have a torpedo-shaped body and often spin out of water while eating. They have specialized cells in their snouts that detect the electric current of nearby prey.
Cats are notoriously volatile animals, as we all know. One moment they are purring for your attention, and the next they can't stand being touched. Now, a Canadian firm has come up with an app that can help you better understand your feline friends. The app is called Tabby and works with artificial intelligence. The AI's algorithm was trained at a clinic in the city of Calgary. The developers of Tabby hope their product can be useful for novice cat owners and vets alike. The app can also help monitor the health of cats. Tabby's developer explains how the app functions.
It uses artificial intelligence, so specifically machine learning, and it's coupled with the feline grimace scale. And what the feline grimace scale is, it's a way for humans to be able to determine if a cat is in pain or not based on the ear positioning, the eye positioning, the muzzle, whiskers, things like that. And so we were able to train a machine using machine learning and a series of images to be able to make that determination. So if you're somebody who has a cat but you don't have that training, you can just use the app and it can help you determine how your cat is doing.
Sounds very useful. The Tabby is not perfect though and runs into problems when trying to decipher the mood of black cats. Despite the hiccups, the developers say the program will get better at doing its task as its artificial intelligence develops through practice.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P. P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Coronavirus-related deaths have recorded 116 deaths in Greater London, England on Tuesday, 10th of August. Tuesday marked the highest number of deaths since 6th of March, when 153 fatalities were recorded in the official data. While the death toll soared, new daily infections have dipped to 23,510 new positive cases. The article you're about to hear has been written by the London Evening Standard journalist Liddy Waddell. The piece is titled, COVID deaths soar to 146 in deadliest days since March as cases dip to 23,510. Coronavirus-related deaths have recorded 146 deaths in Greater London, England on Tuesday, 10th of August. Tuesday marked the highest number of deaths since 6th of March, when 153 fatalities were recorded in the official data. While the death toll soared in Greater London, new daily infections have dipped to 23,510 new positive cases. It compared to Monday's 25,161 new coronavirus daily cases and 37 deaths. Earlier in the day, London's COVID cases by borough were revealed, with 9 areas recording a rise in infections. The new coronavirus data comes hours after Prime Minister Boris Johnson celebrated vaccinating more than 3/4 of adults in the United Kingdom. A total of 86,780,455 doses have been administered in the United Kingdom, with 47,091,889 people receiving a first dose of the vaccine, that is 89%, and 39,688,566 people receiving both doses of the vaccine, that's 75%, according to the DHSC statistics. The Prime Minister Boris Johnson said, "Our incredible vaccine rollout has now provided vital protection against the virus for 3/4 of all UK adults. This is a huge national achievement which we should all be proud of. It's so important that those who haven't been vaccinated come forward as soon as possible to book their jab, to protect themselves, to protect their loved ones, and allow us all to enjoy our freedom safely." Britain's Health Secretary Sajid Javid added 3 in 4 adults across the United Kingdom have now had both doses of the vaccine, which is incredible and a testament to the work of the NHS, volunteers and everyone involved in the vaccine rollout. Also in coronavirus news, the director of the Oxford Vaccine Group said herd immunity was not a possibility with the Delta variant of the coronavirus. Professor Andrew Pollard said herd immunity was mythical and warned a vaccine program should not be built around the idea of achieving it. Speaking to the all-party group on coronavirus, Professor Andrew Pollard said, "Anyone who's still unvaccinated at some point will meet the virus. I think we're in a situation here with this current variant where herd immunity is not a possibility because it still infects vaccinated individuals." Meanwhile, London's battle against COVID-19 cases appears to be stalling, with nine boroughs seeing a rise in weekly infections, official figures reveal on Tuesday, 10th of August. They showed there were 24,162 confirmed cases in the capital, London, in the week to 4th of August, giving a 7-day rate of 268.4 infections per 100,000 Londoners, down 5.4% on the previous week. The weekly drop compares to a fall of 9.3% in the 7 days to August the 3rd, 13.7% to August the 2nd, and 36.3% to July 27th, suggesting the decline in cases is running out of steam. Kingston saw the biggest increase in cases in the week to 4th of August, up 13.4%, followed by Croydon, up 7.3%. and Redbridge, up 5.4%. The largest drop was in Bexley in Kent, down 18.9%, with Westminster dropping 18.8% and Richmond by 16%. The highest 7-day rate was in Hammersmith and Fulham at 367.8 infections per 100,000 people, followed by Lambeth on 354.2 infections and Wandsworth with 319 infections per 100,000 people. And the lowest rate of infection was in Enfield, with 199.9 infections per 100,000 people.
After 300 years of colonization of Indonesia, the Dutch finally had to abandon the occupied lands because that was what the people of Indonesia wanted. Dr. Ahmad Sukarno had been involved in the nationalist activities since his puberty. He then spearheaded the movement for independence from the Netherlands. In 1945, Dr. Ahmad Sukarno announced his people's demand for independence, but the Dutch were not willing to give up 3 centuries of dominance over Indonesia's resources. Therefore, the people of Indonesia had to fight with the Dutch for 4 years to achieve their independence. Historical accounts refer to the 4-year war as savage. Just one example is enough to support this claim. In 1947, in the middle of the Independence War, Dutch soldiers entered the village of Rawagede and killed 341 men and male children of the village before the eyes of their families. Dutch ambassador Tyr de Zouan took part in the 66th anniversary of the Rawagede massacre. He apologized to the families of the victims and said that he was not only there on behalf of his country's government, but also as a representative of the Dutch nation. years of unabated war, the United Nations finally stepped in and the Dutch government had to accept a new governmental system called the Netherlands-Indonesian Union, and the two sides signed a truce. Finally, in 1949, the two sides signed an agreement which stipulated that the entire land of Indonesia, except for New Guinea, be handed over to the interim government of the United States of Indonesia. On December 16, 1949, Dr. Ahmad Sukarno was elected as the president of the country. Contemporary cultural and societal ties between Iran and Indonesia date back to the 1960s and 70s. After years of break, the two sides resumed ties and Iran reopened its embassy in Indonesia. The resumption of diplomatic ties paved the way for the revival of trade and cultural interactions. Their Omidvar brothers might be the first Iranian tourists in Indonesia at those times. Isa and Abdullah Omidvar are Iranian world explorers who started their round-the-world expedition in the 1950s. The two brothers described as sensational the celebrations of Indonesia's independence and the two-hour-long speech by then-President Ahmad Sukarno. The explorers said 10 years after the independence, Indonesians still would end their phone conversations with the word Merdeka, which means independence. 20 years later, in the 1950s, Iran sent a parliamentary delegation headed by then Prime Minister Sharif Emami to Indonesia to take part in the celebrations of the 30th anniversary of the country's independence. Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution did not disrupt the two states' bilateral relations. In fact, the two sides have maintained their close ties at high levels. The presidents of the two nations exchanged official visits and signed memoranda of understanding. Most importantly, it seems that the Islamic Revolution has influenced the public in Indonesia. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Indonesian youth came to Iran for education and became acquainted with the Shiite school of thought. When they would return to their country, they would act as missionaries and promote this way of thinking among their people. That is why experts attribute the recent rise in the number of Shia Muslims in Indonesia to Iran. Today, Shiite Muslims account for around 5 million of the Muslim population in Indonesia. Now, what is the status of Shia Islam in modern-day Indonesia? President Abdurrahman Ar-Rahim, who succeeded General Suharto, headed the organization of Nahdlatul Ulama for a while. The organization was founded by his father. Ar-Rahim regarded himself as a cultural Shia and that he ran an organization with cultural preferences. Such a belief is still preserved by the incumbent leaders of the organization. This means that in addition to the concept of imamat, 12 imams, and other fundamental beliefs, most of the Islamic and ideological teachings in the organization follow the Shia doctrine. Most of the Sufi rituals, pilgrimages, and religious traditions practiced by religious traditionalists are mostly inclined towards Shia Islam. Whenever a person gets sick, a number of people pray for them and reach out to the 5 sacred members of the Prophet Muhammad's household, known as the Ahle Abba. Sunni Muslims still make vows and offer votive foods. There are written pilgrimage prayers inscribed on the tombs of the Sadat, which consist of the names of sacred figures in Shia Islam, such as that of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, Hazrat Zahra, Imam Hassan, and Imam Hussein, peace be upon them. This attests to the fact that Twelver Shia did exist in Indonesia and that Shia Islam lives on in the country. Indonesia is the most populated Muslim country. This is why it attracts significant attention from the world and Muslim countries. In addition to Iran, Saudi Arabia is also seeking to promote its ideology in Indonesia. Wahhabism, which is not congruent with the peaceful nature of the people of Indonesia, Al Saud's activities in Indonesia stretch back to the early 1970s. They launched several Salafi organizations and a number of moderate movements in Indonesia to promote the Hanbali school of jurisprudence in parallel with the Al-Shafi'i school. In the 1970s and 80s, Saudi Arabia published Wahhabi books in Indonesia with low prices. General Suharto became Indonesia's president in 1967 after he led a coup against his predecessor, Ahmad Sukarno. Besides the Indonesian graduates in Saudi Arabia, commentators believe Suharto also played an effective role in the promotion of Wahhabism in Indonesia. They founded Wahhabi centers in Indonesia, which are still operating in the country. The emergence of extremist attitudes towards the followers of other religions and denominations can be linked to efforts by Wahhabi groups in the country. In one particular incident, a leader of congressional prayer of a Wahhabi mosque ordered the expulsion of Shia Muslims and the destruction of their properties. Following this violent order, thousands of men, women, and children were forced to leave the city after their houses were burnt down. In another incident, a crowd set fire to a church while chanting "Allah is great" and razed it to the ground. The emergence of extremist ideologies has created discord among the people of Indonesia and has led to extremist Muslims committing acts of violence against Christians of Indonesia. However, the moral people of Indonesia do not accept such a violent way of thinking. It's the last days of the holy month of Ramadan. Eid al-Fitr is around the corner. Decorations can be seen in four corners of the city to usher in the occasion. All Muslims try their best to get the necessary items to celebrate the festivity. The city is brimming with colors, joy, and happiness. With the sighting of the new moon, the celebrations of Eid al-Fitr get started. Eid al-Fitr is the most important festivity in Indonesia. On the occasion, families dress in the same colors and head to mosques to perform Eid al-Fitr prayer. This harmony in dressing represents unity. After Eid al-Fitr prayer, it's time for family visits. On Eid al-Fitr, everyone is smiling. The people of Indonesia are renowned for being smiley. Here you can always see rows of white teeth, which are not willing to hide behind the lips. Hindus, Buddhists, Christians, and Shia and Sunni Muslims all live together peacefully in this green country. They enjoy their coexistence. They are used to getting together on any occasion and trying to be happy all the time. And of course, everywhere in the country, there are entertainment venues providing happy times for people. It seems that the peaceful people of Indonesia are neither interested in violence, nor do they tolerate the Salafis' deviant way of thinking and their acts of killing. Indonesia is a country with 17,000 dialects, with a beautiful nature. It acts as a bridge between Asia and Oceania. Centuries of colonization in the country have not diminished the Indonesians' love for Islam. This is Indonesia, the land of smiling Islam.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Mare Provincial Governor in Yemen's National Salvation Government, Major General Ali Muhammad Taiman, said the country's army troops and fighters from allied popular committees will establish full control over the entire districts of the central province of Marib in case Saudi-led militants refuse calls for a ceasefire in the strategic area. We're prepared for you an article written by Karine Jaffery, an independent journalist and blogger, under the heading, Yemeni Government's Initiative for Ending War in Marib. Simultaneously with the appointment of the United Nations new envoy to Yemen, consultations as well as political and diplomatic pressures, and of course the United States and the UK's entreaty for an end to the war in Yemen, sustain themselves. The Yemeni army and popular committee's extensive victories over the past 2 weeks have caused the American side to finally despair of stopping Ansar Allah movement through military means and seek out another approach. It was for this reason that the White House's envoy for Yemen made several trips to the region over the recent weeks. She visited Riyadh and Muscat, meeting with the country's officials. The Saudi side practically fights for the Americans and lacks all internal inclination towards the continuation of the war. However, it is trying to exit while still saving its face. For the American side, the fate of the city of Marib is very important, and it is engaging in the consultations for the same reason. Over the past 7 years, the British and the Americans did not spare any crime against the Yemeni nation, crimes of such enormity that just some things slightly resemble them have happened in a country such as China or Russia. These countries would have had 7 or 8 resolutions issued against them and faced hundreds of condemnations on the part of the bogus Western human rights organizations. Nevertheless, all these pressures led nowhere, and starving the Yemeni people did not make them sell out their scruples. The West's heavy investment in Ma'arib province did not bring along any victory for them. Their direct interference in the war in the city showed that although they may be the bigger in numbers and have greater equipment at their disposal, they have nothing on the Yemeni fighters in the area of designing and enacting battleground operations. Simply put, it should be said that the Emiratis departed from the battleground about 2 years ago and admitted defeat. The Saudis are awaiting the smallest sign on the part of London and Washington, and the latter two themselves are facing a deadlock too. The Sana'a forces are leading a winning strategy which features a gradual approach towards the city. Their scenario comprises laying a siege on the city, either directly or taking it under a barrage of fire. Doing this, they would be leaving the coalition's forces just one outreach pathway through Hadramaut province. The Ma'arib battle signifies greatly, since defeat in it equals the defeat of Mohammed bin Salman's adventurism in Yemen. Moreover, the war has impacted greatly on Saudi Arabia too, because it has caused it to come under successive rocket and drone attacks by Yemen's Ansar Allah movement. The war casts a long shadow on Saudi Arabia. However, after the US Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman's trip to Muscat, and on a demand made by the Omani side, Yemen's National Salvation Government submitted its initiative for ending the war in Ma'arib province to the Omani diplomatic mission. The initiative is actually the most dangerous one that the Yemenis have put on the table. And if the Saudis and the Americans do not accept it, Ma'arib would be besieged from the direction of the Shabwa province. Here are the provisions of the initiative. One, formation of a common directorate comprised of Ma'arib locals towards the protection of security and stability, and expulsion of Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorists from Yemen. 2. Provision of guarantees of freedom of movement, freedom of all the abductees, compensation for those who suffered during the coalition's aggression, return of those who have been displaced and migrated from the province, and an end to aggression on Ma'arib's residents. 3. Allocation of the revenues that are made from exports of oil derivatives from the Hodeidah port to the provision of payment for Ma'arib's people. 4. Renewal of the operations of the province's gas power plant, guaranteed commitment to the provision of the other province's share of oil and gas, and formulation of a joint committee tasked with repairing the Safa-operated Ras Isa oil pipeline. Previously too, Mohammed Abdel Salam, head of Sana'a's negotiating team and Ansar Allah movement spokesman, had told the Al-Mayadeen television network, he said, "We came to an agreement with the Omani delegation over the resolution of the humanitarian case. We see no inclination on the part of the enemy coalition's constituent countries towards peace, and it is just the Omani side which has initiated the negotiation process here. Our initiative awaits the approval of the other side. The initiative features agreement on freedom of all those who are captive in Ma'arib province and compensation for those who have suffered. We also agreed on Ma'arib's governance by its own people, through an all-inclusive governing body. Abdelmalek al-Ojari, one of Ansarullah movement's leading figures, has also said previously that the Ansarullah had assumed that Maghrib battle would not be easy. We have not set a timetable for the conflict. The goal is to liberate the city. We take steps towards liberating it, as well as other occupied cities and provinces, from the filth of the occupiers. The Yemeni army and Yemeni popular committees have adopted a military strategy that suits the region's geographical terrain. Moreover, another senior Yemeni official says the country's armies and troops of fighters from allied popular committees will establish full control over the entire district of the central province of Maghrib in case Saudi-led militants refuse calls for a ceasefire in the strategic area. Maghrib provincial governor in Yemen's National Salvation Government, Major General Ali Muhammad Tayman, told Lebanon's Arabic language Al Mayadeen television network that the Yemeni army troops and allies are now in control of 85% of the Maghrib province and are only about 6 to 7 kilometers away from the provincial capital of the same name. General Ali Muhammad Tayman added, the Yemeni armed forces are currently positioned on the outskirts of Maghrib city, stressing that we agreed to the initiative by the leader of Yemen's popular Ansarullah resistance movement, Abdelmalek Badreddin al-Houthi, for a ceasefire. However, Saudi militants loyal to Yemen's fugitive former president, Abdelrabb Mansour Hadi, kept bombing women and children. We want peace and strongly oppose bloodshed. He added, Houthi's initiative is fair as it involves the locals of Maghrib in its administration and appropriation of its resources. Such an initiative had not been developed for the past 40 years. We presented the Truth Initiative from a position of strength. General Ali Muhammad Tayman highlighted that he was ready to sit with his counterpart in Abdelrabb Mansour Hadi's administration, Major Sultan Al Arada, either in the Juba district or in Sirwa, in order to discuss the initiative and stop skirmishes in Maghrib province. He added, we hope Saudi mercenaries in Maghrib would agree to Houthi's initiative and quickly implement it if they want to spare the province from war and destruction. The senior Yemeni official noted, if the mercenaries have the courage to take the decision, we're ready to sit down with them. Major General Tayman said, while we follow the initiative and are waiting for the other side's actions, no measure has unfortunately been taken yet. Yemeni army forces and fighters from popular committees would not hesitate to liberate the rest of Maghrib in case Saudi mercenaries turn down the Truth Initiative. Aid agencies say tens of thousands of Yemenis are in dire need of medical care, have been stranded by the tight Saudi blockade of the country, particularly around Sana'a International Airport. The Norwegian Refugee Council, NRC, and the Cooperative for Assistance and Relief Everywhere, CARE, have reported that 32,000 people in northern Yemen have not been able to travel outside Yemen for potentially life-saving treatment. The Norwegian Refugee Council NRC's acting country director, Isaac Oko, said, it's like a hostage situation that has lasted for 5 years. He added, patients are trapped in Yemen even where there is a route to save them. For thousands of sick Yemenis who need urgent medical treatment abroad, these last 5 years have amounted to a death sentence. The Norwegian Refugee Council, NRC, and Assistance and Relief Everywhere, CARE, said the closure of the airport, coupled with Saudi restrictions on goods entering the north of the country through Hodeidah port, has nearly halted the entry of medicines, medical supplies and equipment, causing prices to soar, making healthcare unaffordable for most Yemenis and contributing to the unraveling of the healthcare system in the country. Sana'a Airport Director Khaled Al-Shayef said there are international demands to open Sana'a Airport as a result of the catastrophic humanitarian repercussions of its continued closure, but the Saudi-dominated coalition countries are still insisting on linking this to other files, including military and political ones. Saudi Arabia, backed by the United States and its regional allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March of 2015 with the goal of bringing fugitive President Abdul Rabah Mansour Hadi's government back to power and crushing the popular Ansar-Allah resistance movement. However, Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees have gone from strength to strength against the Saudi-led invaders and left Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country. The war has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions more. It has also destroyed Yemen's infrastructure and spread famine and infectious diseases across the country.
Around the world with reporters.
Ibrahim Raisi handed to Parliament a list of his proposed cabinet ministers a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators now have 1 week to review the credentials of Raisi's picks before an open vote of confidence session is held with the presence of the president himself to defend his nominees.
For 1 week, 13 parliament commissions will be working three shifts a day, where they will be host the proposed ministers, asking them about their plans and visions. 3 days after the one-week time frame is over, open sessions will be held in parliament, where the proposed ministers will take the podium one by one to lay out their plans and take questions from lawmakers.
The list consists of 19 nominees for 19 ministerial posts. Among the proposed names are Hossein Amir Abdullahian as the new foreign minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani as the defense minister, and Ismail Khatib as the intelligence minister. Lawmakers seem to not have issues with the proposed list and have promised to be cooperative with the new administration.
There will definitely be synergy and convergence between parliament and the government. We need to work together to solve the country's economic problems. We are determined to remove the illegal sanction imposed on the nation, so lawmakers and the new administration must join hands to achieve this goal.
Ibrahim Raisi won the June 18th election by a landslide, securing 64% of the vote. He was sworn in on August 4th, 2 days after he was officially endorsed by Iran's leader. Raisi had 2 weeks to introduce his proposed cabinet lineup, but he released the list a week ahead of the deadline. Parliament says it will be swift to review the nominated ministers in order to speed up the formation of the new cabinet.
If all goes as planned, open floor vote of confidence sessions will be held after the week-long deliberations over the credentials of the proposed ministers will conclude behind closed doors. Given the close ties between the Iranian parliament and the new government, lawmakers expect that the vote of confidence process will wrap up in a matter of 3 work shifts. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In an attempt to blunt international opposition to Israeli settlement construction in the occupied territories, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is pushing through plans for more than 2,000 settler units in the occupied West Bank, and at the same time has decided, after long years, to grant a rare authorization for 836 Palestinian homes in Area C of the occupied West Bank. It's virtually impossible for Palestinians to get construction permits from Israeli authorities. Palestinians say Bennett is trying to deceive the world by the so-called equalization.
All this announcement is just to tell a fake message to the world that